Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you guys doing? Good. I grew up in Montana, Kalispell, Montana. So my dad was a pastor there. He had five churches. And one of the churches was a small church just like this one. And I have such good memories there. I love this building. I love listening to your stories. I miss having that prayer and praise time that we don't get often in bigger churches. The time to just really share our stories, our heartaches, our joys. And it was good to get a little sneak peek into your guys' lives. I really appreciate that. So I grew up in Montana. I'm a theology major now at Walla University. A few years ago, we moved to Vancouver, British Columbia. And so my family is currently still living in Canada there. I went to Fountain View Academy for 2 years before going on to Walla University, where I'm at. Now I'm graduating this year, so I'm very excited. So it's good to be here, and I thank you guys for inviting me, and I'm here because Cameron, you guys know Cameron Fitzgerald, he's a friend of mine, and he set me up today, so I appreciate that. So, in the year 1914, on June 28, two shots rang out in the streets of the Serbian capital, Sarajevo. On that day, two people died, a man and a woman. Murders like these happen all the time. People die all the time, and that's sad, and that's painful, and that shouldn't be the case, but this happens all the time. But this murder was different, because the man that was killed that day was the crown prince of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, an empire that doesn't exist anymore. But in 1914, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, when they found out their crown prince had just been killed, they declared war on the country where he had been killed, on Serbia. And next, their ally, Germany, would invade and attack France. In the process, they invaded Belgium. And because Belgium was attacked, England joined the fight. And because England joined the fight, Russia joined the fight. And eventually, the entire world was engaged in a worldwide war. America would finally come in. Canada would come in along with Britain. This war would leave 18 million people dead and 23 million people wounded. It was a terrible war. A war where people would have to run into machine gun fire hoping to end this terrible war. But no, this was all started by a single assassination. That single assassination brought the entire world into chaos. A single action set in motion World War I. Actions have influence. Actions have powerful influence. And while none of us here today likely have ever set into motion a worldwide war, hopefully, our actions still do have powerful influence. This leads me to an interesting question, one that I think we need to ask ourselves every day. What impact does the witness of my life have on those around me? What impact does the witness of my life, so the way I live my life, how does that impact those who are around me? What influence do I have? I think to answer this question, I want to open up our Bibles to 2 Kings chapter 5. 2 Kings chapter 5, that's in the Old Testament. It comes after the Pentateuch and before the Psalms. It's before, you know, before it come 1 and 2 Samuel. We have the Judges, Ruth, Deuteronomy. Israel's in a very fascinating place at this time. But 2 Kings chapter 5. There's a story of a young girl who makes a big difference. Naaman is the general of the land of Aram, a small but powerful kingdom north of Israel. At one point, Aram had under the control of Israel when David was king and Israel was powerful. But since then, it's split into north and south, and the north has endured a series of really bad kings that have brought about spiritual and political decline. Aram eventually, long time before this, had gained its independence and had become a strong and powerful kingdom that was just north of Israel that liked to attack Israel. Another name for Syria, sorry, for Aram is Syria. And if I can connect this to modern events, just yesterday, the United States launched missiles to attack the capital of Syria, Damascus. Damascus was Naaman's hometown. That's where he would have lived. So in Israel, sitting on the king on the throne in Israel, is Ahab's son. Ahab had died in a battle with Syria a few years before, and now Ahab's son is sitting there, and he is not doing a good job. He is afraid. He is struggling. There had been sporadic war between Syria and Israel for many years. Naaman had probably been there at that battle when Ahab died. You remember the big battle, we have Jehoshaphat and Ahab fighting, and there Naaman was probably along with his soldiers fighting and killing Ahab. There had been a bit of peace after the death of Ahab, and God was going to use this opportunity to perform a powerful miracle and possibly bring peace between Syria and Israel. Let's turn to 2 Kings chapter 5. And verse 1. In this verse, we're introduced to Naaman, who's a powerful man who God takes a special interest in. Verse 1. Naaman, commander of the army of Israel, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great man with his master and in high favor because of him. And the Lord had given victory to Syria. He was a mighty man of valor. But he was a leper. Naaman was blessed by God, but despite his power, his wealth, his valor, his strength, he had a sickness, a terrible sickness. We don't know exactly what leprosy is. It might be something like Hansen's disease, the more classic leprosy, where you lose that sense of feeling in your hands and slowly you start to decay and you can't heal very well after these diseases. It's a terrible disease. That's possibly what it had. It might be that he had a different type of skin disease that was really, you know, a problem in his life, something that was really holding him back. And so he's someone who has been blessed by God, but he has a problem. He has leprosy. Now, when Naaman was out raiding one time with his armies, he had captured a young Israelite girl. We don't know her name, but she is important nonetheless. And she introduced Naaman to hope. Let's continue the story in verse 2. Verse 2 in your Bibles. Now, the Syrians, on one of their raids, carried off a little girl from the land of Israel, and she worked in the service of Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "Would that my lord were with the prophet who is in Samaria. He would cure him of his leprosy." So Naaman went in and told his lord, "Thus and so," I love how the Bible says that, "thus and so said," spoke the girl from the land of Israel. And the king of Syria said, "Go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So he went, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. Now, I just want to stop here for a second and point out two misconceptions that Naaman went to Israel with. First of all, he thought the prophet could heal him. He thought the prophet could cure him. As helpful as the girl was, she said, "There's a prophet in Israel who can heal you." But who really would heal Naaman? It's God. So God is the one that really heals Naaman, not the prophet. The prophet is not some all-powerful person. It's God in heaven that's a powerful one. And so he has that first misconception. The second misconception is that he can purchase God's healing with gold or silver. You see in verse 5, it talks about these 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. I did some research on this, okay? I went on the internet, I searched for different things, I tried looking at the current, you know, price of gold and did the proper exchange rates and something like that. And I also found out the price of gold has been steady for at least the last 2,000 years. We look at Roman centurions and how much they were being paid, and it's equivalent to what it would be today. And so most people that I read, when they calculated the clothing, they calculated the silver and the gold, they said this is about $1 million he's bringing. This is $1 million. So this is an important general. He's gone to his king, and his king is like, okay, I will give you $1 million so you can go and buy a cure from the prophet in Israel. So two misconceptions. First of all, it's the prophet who's the strong one who's going to do some kind of incantation. He's the powerful one. And second, Naaman thinks he can purchase God's healing. With his camels loaded high, and a letter from the king of Syria, and probably a large military escort to carry this $1 million along the way, Naaman set out to Samaria, the capital of Israel. He arrives in the court of the king of Israel, but there's a bit of a mix-up. Something does not work out right here. The king of Israel assumes that he has to heal in himself. Ahab's son, this fearful man here, he had no more faith than his father had before him. If he would have trusted in God in this situation, he would have realized that God could heal him. But instead, he reads the letter and he's like, oh no, I have to be it. The faith of the king is non-existent. The king's fearful doubt stands in stark contrast to the innocent faith of the young captive girl. We have the girl back in Damascus. She is a captive. She has no family around her, and yet she has faith in the prophet of Israel. And yet the king of Israel, who's living in the capital of Israel, along with Elisha, who is the prophet at that time, doesn't even think about Elisha. He just gets afraid. Let's read it in verse 6. And he, that's Naaman, brought the letter to the king of Israel, which read, when this letter reaches you, know that I have sent you Naaman, my servant, that you may cure him of his leprosy. And then the king of Israel read the letter. He tore his clothes and said, am I God to kill and make alive that this man sends word to me to cure a man of his leprosy? Only consider and see how he is seeking a quarrel with me. Naaman thought that if Israel worshipped God, then its king would be very close to the prophet. But that was not the case. The king of Israel should have been used to consulting the prophet. The king of Israel should be good friends with the prophet of God and had him in his courtroom so that when this situation, the Naaman assumed, hey, I can just send this letter to the king and the king will send me right to the prophet and it'll be perfect. But no, that was not the case. The king of Israel did not know the prophet. He was not close to him. He was not used to having that relationship. Elisha gets word, though. He hears about this really embarrassing conduct, and he says, hey, send Naaman to me. Get him over here so he can see that there is a prophet in Israel. So Naaman's grand entourage travels out the crowded cities of Samaria. I can imagine the camels and the horses and the chariots like trying to get through the mud. They're like, the palace is back there. Why do we have to go over here to some residential place? They're traveling through the streets there, and they finally arrive at Elisha's house. And Elisha's already there to get these dignitaries, right? He's standing outside. He's like, welcome, dignitaries from the land of our enemies. I want to invite you in. That's not the case. He sends a messenger and he says, go take a bath. Get out of here. Verse 9. So Naaman came with his horses and chariots and stood at the door of Elisha's house. And Elisha sent a messenger to him saying, go and wash in the Jordan 7 times and your flesh will be restored and you'll be clean. Interesting. Why would Elisha do this? Was he trying to be rude? Was he trying to show Naaman who's boss? Was he trying to, I wouldn't even come close to this Gentile swine? Was that his idea? Was he afraid of contracting leprosy from being around Naaman? I don't think any of those are the situation. Instead, Elisha is communicating something very specific. He's saying, I'm not the one who heals you. I'm not the one with the power. The Lord is powerful. The Lord is the one who heals you. I'm just his servant. By not showing up, by not being the one who waves his hands around and makes a big show and flash He's healed. Naaman is communicating something very important. He says, God is the one that's going to heal you. I'm not involved. I'm just the messenger. I'm just someone who can direct you towards God. But Naaman didn't get this message initially, did he? He was pretty angry. Here he had traveled all this way on some girl's, young girl's message. He wanted a grand show of magic. He wanted flash, boom, bang, boom, he's healed. He wanted something big and exciting. He wanted incantations and soothsaying. He wanted a big show, but that's not what he got. Instead, he had to go skinny dip in some dirty river. He was not excited about that. Verse 11, we get that story right here. But Naaman was angry and went away, saying, behold, I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call upon the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash them and be clean? So he turned away and went away in a rage. So Naaman, super angry, jumps back in his chariot and begins galloping back to Syria. Just forget all this. I'm going as fast as I can back home. This was embarrassing. My army is going to make sure they pay for this embarrassment. He's on his way home. But about one day's journey, if you look at a map, from Samaria back to Damascus, one day he has to cross the Jordan River. On his way back home, he has to cross the Jordan River. And eventually his servants, hopefully they had a faster chariot than him, they catch up to him, and they're like, hey man, you can try it out. Just try it out. You already have to go through the river. Just stop, do a few dips, and just test out the word of the prophet. Naaman enters the water. He's convinced. And the results are stunning. Verse 13. But his servants came near and said to him, my father, is it a great word the prophet has spoken to you? Would you not do it? Has he actually said to you, wash and be clean? So he went down and dipped himself 7 times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. Naaman chooses to act in the same faith as his little captive girl. And because of his faith, his skin is restored to be just like a little child, just like her skin. He had her faith, and he got her skin. He got the skin of a young child. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that so cool? So we have this young girl, through her faith, through her willingness to witness to Naaman. Naaman, the commander of an enemy army, has now been healed by God. And he is grateful. He is very grateful. He does not just to say, hey, that was great. Let's go back home. I got this free. This is going to be awesome. No, he turns around and he gallops all the way back to Samaria. He's praising God. He is declaring his faith. He's saying, I will worship God from now on. And also, here is $1,000,000. Thank you for helping me out. Hey, that's pretty cool. A lot of money. Elisha should be like, yep, donating it to the temple fund. It's going to be great. Is that what he chooses to do? Verse 15. Then he returned to the man of God, he and his company, and he came and stood before him. And he said, behold, I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. So accept now a present from your servant. Hands him $1,000,000. But Elisha said, as the Lord lives before whom I stand, I will receive none. And he urged him to take it, but he refused. Then Naaman said, if not, please let there be given to your servant 2 mule loads of earth. For from now on, your servant will offer burnt offerings, no burnt offerings or sacrifices to any god but the Lord. Elisha made two things very clear. Number one, God's favor cannot be purchased. And 2, Elisha did not serve God for his own gain. God doesn't want his money. He wants his worship. You see that? In those verses, we see, first of all, he's like, there's no other God but the God who's in Israel. So here's the money. Here, I can pay my debt to that God. Elisha says, no. And then Naaman says, if that's the case, if then, I'm going to worship God for the rest of my life. Please, give me some dirt so I can take this dirt back to my place and worship on that dirt. We understand his view of God is still limited. It's still broken. He still thinks God is tied to the actual dirt of his land. It's a common view in that time. But he believes he's going to worship God. He now has gratitude, and he's going back to Syria with huge gratitude in his heart. Elisha eventually says to him, go in peace. Go in peace. And so he turns around full of gratitude, full of praise for the God of Israel, and I'm sure full of goodwill towards the people of Israel. He turns back to his own place. So our witnesses so far, the servant girl and the prophet, have revealed God's true character. If only the story ended there. We have one more witness to get through. This witness is going to throw a wrench in the works. He puts greed above God's purpose. This witness is Gehazi. Gehazi is angry. He thinks this foreigner got off too easy. He says, Naaman, that Syrian doesn't deserve what he got. He should have to pay at least something. And so he gets a plan in his mind. He works it out. He puts on his running shoes, and he takes off running after that chariot. Thankfully, Naaman's not galloping this time. He's trying to spend as much time in Israel as possible, so he's slowly traveling back. Naaman, looking behind him, he sees that someone is coming. He jumps down out of his chariot, showing humility and change. This man has changed. When he sees a servant running to him, he doesn't just stop his chariots and say, okay, what do you want? No, he jumps out of his chariot. He runs down. He says, hey, what's up, my friend? How can I help out? Anything you want. Gehazi is like, definitely. Elisha definitely sent me. He has two guests. They're staying in town. Please give them, $100,000 or so. That's about as much as he asked for. Still a lot of money. Naaman says, I'll give you double that. Here's $200,000. Take it back. I'm so happy. So happy and thankful. Happy? Does that work? No. I'm so thankful. I'm so happy. You're great. Gehazi hides the money and sneaks back into Elisha's house. So let's analyze what Gehazi did here. I think it was terrible. It undermined everything Elisha had tried to communicate. Now, Naaman could say, I paid God back for healing me. And Elisha, he profited quite well from the whole ordeal. He went back to Syria thinking his debt to God was paid. Before he had gone back to Syria thinking, I'm going to worship God for the rest of my life because he gave me a free gift of grace. He gave me a free gift of healing so I can live a beautiful, good life now. Now he goes back to Syria saying, my wealth, yeah, I helped out Elisha quite well. My debt to that God is paid. It's a transaction. He gave me something. I gave him something. My debt to them is paid. I can go back to Israel and be just fine. Naaman's treasure was hidden away. Naaman had gone back to Syria. Gehazi sulked back into Elisha's house. But Elisha was standing there waiting. He knew what Gehazi had done, and somehow in his prophetic vision, he had seen what had happened. Naaman had meant this gift to be a blessing, but instead it became a curse upon Naaman, upon Gehazi. Verse 25. Let's skip down to verse 25. He went in and stood before his master, and Elisha said to him, where have you been, Gehazi? And he said, your servant went nowhere. But he said to him, did not my heart go when the man turned from his chariot to meet you? Was it a time to accept money or garments or olive orchards, or vineyards, or sheep, or oxen, or male servants, or female servants. Therefore, the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and your descendants forever." So he went out from that, from his presence, a leper like snow. How we live our lives, whether for better or for worse, has great influence on those around us, no matter our status. How we live our lives, whether for better or for worse, has great influence on those around us, no matter of our status. Just as the simple servant girl, through her witness, was able to start a grand expedition that would lead to the conversion of an enemy general. And just as Gehazi, through his greed and selfishness, was able to impair Naaman's faith, we also, through the simple witness of our lives, can bring people closer or further from God. How much did Gehazi really hinder Naaman's faith? This is something that I've thought a little bit about. I think some might argue this. Well, how bad was it really? You know, how bad was what Gehazi really did? His punishment was harsh. He got a death sentence. He had to be excluded from society for his and all his family. That's pretty terrible. I mean, come on. He was just trying to take advantage of a good situation. Money is not inherently bad. That money could have been put to a good cause, just as Judas said. You know, we could have given that to the poor. We could have helped people out. But as I've thought about this, I realized his actions had terrible outcomes. Syria and Israel, the relationship between them did not get better after this story. In chapter 6, Syria is attacking Elisha. This is chapter 5, this story. The next chapter, the same king, possibly with the same general Naaman, was sending an army to surround the city to capture and possibly kill Elisha, the man who had just healed Naaman. In chapter 7, so that's chapter 6. Chapter 5, he's healed. Chapter 6, they're attacking Elisha. Chapter 7, they're besieging Samaria. Syria would continue to plague Israel. They continue to fight for years and years and years until finally the great and terrible Assyrian Empire from the east would come through and smash both Syria and Israel and control them and scatter Israel throughout the world. What if Naaman hadn't felt that his debt to God was paid? What if he, out of gratitude, convinced the king of Syria to make peace? How many lives would have been spared? That's a hard question. Perhaps if Naaman had gone back to Syria with peace in his heart, with gratitude, worshiping the God of Israel and no other, perhaps he could have sat down with the king of Syria and said, "Hey man, can we work this out with him? Can we choose to maybe attack someone else? Can we choose to make peace with these people? They gave so much money, and I don't want to go attack and kill them again." That's not what happened. But we can learn from Gehazi's mistakes. We can choose to live our lives to influence those around us for the better. So what should our witness be? How can we best influence those around us? I think Paul puts it best when he says, "If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all." That is our calling, to live at peace, to teach peace, to give peace to those around us. This means that we need to treat our spouses and put their wants and desires over our own, their needs over our own. This means bearing with your children's mistakes and their thoughtlessness, even their rebellion. This means respecting parents, even when they're totally not cool or totally abrasive. This means listening to our teachers or treating our classmates with dignity, not just our close friends, but the weird and gross ones, the ones who treat you harshly, the ones who talk behind your backs. This means including the misfits, encouraging the anxious or the depressed. This means listening to your boss even when they're harsh or even when they're not a team player. This means working with your coworkers, even when they treat you harshly. This means treating your neighbors with selfless love, even when their dog poops on your lawn. This means helping them through the difficult times in their family and celebrating them with the good times. This means looking for needs and being present for those who are struggling. This means treating those who are different with respect. It means including immigrants. It means accepting refugees. It means feeding the homeless, visiting the prisoners. It means being an ally to the oppressed and standing up for those who are marginalized. It means treating those who you disagree with politically or religiously or even ethically with honor and listening to them and trying to understand their point of view. This means looking for those who are longing for something more and showing them Jesus. This means living at peace. Everyone has power of influence. Through our actions, through the lives we live, we can affect those around us to see Jesus and spirituality better. Life at peace is not easy. It requires getting rid of our impulses, pushing down our desires, and putting all those things second. It means controlling our anger, our indignation, our sense of entitlement. It means putting the rights of others above our own rights. But I promise you, it's worth it. Today, I want to make a call to you guys. I want you to commit to living a life of peacemaking, a life that you can be proud of, a life where you're a witness to those around you. I believe that you guys will do this. Amen.